This is KBLU-LP in Logan. My name is Richard Arlen Blake, and I'd like to welcome you all back to the seventh episode of Balladishenish, or Folklore Now. Considering what time of year it is, there were a few things about D-Day that I was contemplating talking about, but I am not going to do that in this podcast because there's several other things that I want to talk about that are coming up, other things that are a little more folkloric that would best be used here in the podcast. I will have a independent podcast, however, that deals specifically with D-Day, and I will be reading two personal accounts that were given by soldiers who took part in D-Day. And so I hope you all listen to that. I will have that on my Folklore YouTube page, and possibly I could have that in my podcast sections as well. Now, the topics today I want to talk about, I guess first I'd like to talk about linguistics. So linguistics is one of those topics that I have just always been really fascinated with. Ever since I was really young, I've always been really interested in different languages, how they sound, how different languages are related, looking for those common traits of those similar languages like Spanish and French or Irish and Welsh, things that you might hear that don't sound all that similar, but which are definitely related if you know what to look for. Because if you look at English and German, you might say, well, those things don't sound at all alike. But if you pick out a few things, German doesn't have as much French pollution in it as English does, and so that's part of the reason why they sound so different. But if we look at phrases like can't do, which means can you do this, or ich bin Richard, I am Richard, these kinds of things are really similar. Ich bin, I am, but bin and is similar to the English word being, I have been, or whatever. They just have a slightly different usage for that particular word that sounds the same. Just like if you whip out a copy of The Hobbit written in German, you'll find out that the Hobbit lives in a hole as opposed to a cave. The German word for cave is hole. One of those things that I like looking into. And in some respects, German has a lot of things that make it easier to learn as opposed to other things. The reason why linguistics, I believe, can fall into the folklore realm, or the reason why it gets dragged in there, is because of, well, one, because of the stories that people are always telling. They use different languages sometimes to find those stories in. Nowadays, a lot of stories seem to be mostly written down in English because they want to get the bigger audience as possible. I personally don't like that. I don't mind having a translation of a story that someone's telling, but I feel that in an original language that an idea comes into with that culture, I believe that that is the best medium through which that story should be told. You can get up off your lazy butt and try and work on learning that particular story and what it exactly means yourself if you need to. Going with those languages, it's kind of interesting some of the directions that linguistics goes. Now, there is a language in Scotland, and yes, I consider it a language, even if some people consider it a dialect, that is called Scots. Now, the Scots language technically would be called a Germanic language, like English is a Germanic language, and English is its closest relative. But there are so many things about it that are different from English that you have to admit, okay, this might warrant separate language status. If you see it written down, you will see a lot of similarities of words. And if you kind of spill it out with the bad English way of pronouncing Scots, then you could probably figure out what most of it means. However, there's a lot of stuff that isn't going to be as understandable. And when I had learned about the existence of Scots, I was out shopping at a bookstore and I saw this dictionary that said Scots. And ever since I picked up that dictionary, I've been kind of studying Scots ever since, but I'm not very good at it because I can't do that Scottish accent too well. But there have been quite a few things translated into Scots. I might actually have a separate podcast dealing with Scots because there's just so much to say about it. The reason why this fits into folklore is there is a trend, of course, to go and translate things into other languages, and a lot of things are translated into Scots. I mean, I found an Alice in Wonderland that was translated into Scots, and I found a Harry Potter that was translated into Scots as well. And I found a couple people who've been talking about that had some interesting things to say about it. Reading these things, pulling out a book written in another language, just totally fascinates me. When you have these languages where, like Scots, that has a dominating neighbor, meaning English, you have an issue where a lot of things are not written down in that language itself too much. There is poetry that is written in that language because before English began to dominate Northern Britain, the Scots were isolated and had their own language that kind of developed on its own. And a lot of early literature was written in that language. But I really was disappointed when I discovered that there were no storytellers who spoke in that language when they were telling their stories. The one person that I had come across who was from a Scots-speaking region that was a storyteller said that he'd never really told any of his stories in Scots because he wants his audience to understand everything he's saying. And up in the Orkney region, there's also a lot of Scandinavian influence, and that can make things really interesting as well. Anyways, that deals with the language of Scots. And another interesting thing language-wise that I came across was on YouTube, I found a couple things that were on Ireland's Irish language channel. There was a show there that is called No Berla. And what No Berla means in Irish is no English. And Irish, the Irish language, is the official national language of Ireland. And for those of you who don't know, Irish means Irish Gaelic. There's more than one kind of Gaelic, and so the Irish want to make sure you understand that they're talking about their kind when they call it Irish. What he did was he went all over Ireland. He especially went to some places where the language was supposedly has a stronghold and was still around. But he would walk around these pubs, these stores, and he would speak nothing but Irish to these people. And so many of them had no idea what he was saying. They had to go find someone that could talk to him. And it was just really interesting. It's like, gee, Irish, according to the Irish Constitution, is the national language of Ireland. And yet people just didn't speak it. And I just thought that was really interesting how that worked out. And I'm just hoping that the Irish people can sort of rectify that and learn their language more, even though English might seem more conveniently and useful in this day and age. But when I was in Dublin, last time I was in Dublin, I did bump into a couple of 10-year-old girls or 10 or 11-year-old girls with the study group I was with. And these girls, they spoke Irish perfectly. And I was kind of surprised because in Dublin, I really had not encountered a lot of Irish speakers. I mean, there's an Irish language bookstore and Irish language areas where that are specifically designated. They pride themselves on knowing their Irish language. But most places, if you go up there and say, Kajemaratatu, you know, how are you doing? They're not going to know what to say. You know, Tamigamai Garmahagit, I'm fine, thank you, is how most people would respond to that, or Tashe Gadona, meaning I'm doing terrible. So there's your Irish language for the day. In Wales, I found that the people there, if you walk up to a stranger in Northern Wales and just start speaking Welsh, odds are you're more likely to find someone who can speak Welsh back. I found that really interesting. But just about everyone who works in a government office in Wales, in North Wales, I guess I should say, I don't know about South Wales. I know that numerically or percentage-wise, Southern Wales has a lower percentage of Welsh speakers to the population. But in North Wales, you can walk up, talk to a stranger in Welsh, and odds are they can speak Welsh back to you. There are a few towns that are mostly designated English towns because a lot of the people there either migrated from England or their ancestors did, or people forgot the language because for a long time they were trying to eradicate it. But the Welsh were pretty resilient, and I'm thankful for that. These languages really are beautiful, and I do want them to stay around because as long as the language stays around, the culture attached to that language stays around as well. And I do basically agree with Patrick Pearce's idea of tir gan tenaga, tir gan anam, meaning a land without a language is a land without a soul. The language indigenous of Ireland really needs to stick around, as well as in Wales, and as well as the Basque language or Scottish Gaelic and those others. This is what I have to say on the linguistics front. Like I said, I may have a podcast designated to the Scots language because there are so many interesting things about it that I believe are important. That's what I have to say about languages. Now, for those of you who were paying attention, Memorial Day also just passed us by. And when these kinds of days come around, we always put our flag up to commemorate those people who have taken part in our military, people who have died for their country fighting wars, or people who have died for other reasons in service of their country. And when I was younger, my family had this tradition that we would all head on out to a local cemetery and we would lay flowers there by some of the graves. None of the people that were in those graves were anybody that we even knew. And we, of course, we go and we put flowers on graves of family members when we go through the cemeteries. But these people, these brave people who died for us, who died fighting for the cause of freedom or for America in its endeavors in order to keep this country safe or to free other countries from tyranny. We felt that it was important that at least somebody paid these people respects if no one else did. If these people did not have any family members, we wanted to make sure that someone was commemorating them. And I heard that this is pretty much a common tradition to a lot of people. The local cemetery, interestingly enough, when I was growing up in Concord, California, was kind of off to the side and up on a hill in a park where there was a flag. Now, from the bottom of the hill, you couldn't really tell what the heck was up there. It might have just been, I wonder what's on the top of that hill. And then you might walk up there and say, it's a cemetery. Maybe it was just the trend of, we want these cemeteries there, but we don't want them to necessarily stand out. At least, not standing out like the cemetery here over at Utah State University that's on the grounds with all the statues and the art and the graveyard art that's there. Graveyard art is something that I really only appreciated lately when I was shown by my folk art teacher. Culturally, people have a lot of things that they like to show, that they like to emphasize when they put up those gravestones. But these particular gravestones weren't really fancy. They did have crosses on them. Most of them had crosses on them. And of course, that is a tradition of showing respect. Nowadays, I hear people saying, that's a religious symbol. We shouldn't put that here and blah, blah, blah. It's like, it might have started out as a religious symbol in many respects, but this is just showing gratitude. This is the symbol of honoring the fallen. And whether it started out as religious or not, that's not what these particular gravestones are meant to portray. I went to this particular graveyard. I can't remember how many. I didn't move out of California until I was 21, but we had been there all the way up until some of my family members moved out of the house. We would always go up there. And when I was younger, I would say, this is boring. I don't want to do this, blah, blah, blah. I guess being a kid at the time, you do not respect everything. Your parents kind of have to grill that into you and make you realize, excuse me, today is not about you, it's about them. And so, Memorial Day, it is really important to remember those people who have fought and died for us. Another Day coming up, which is of great significance, of course, is June 14th. Now, does everybody know what happens on June 14th? Why, it's Flag Day. That Flag Day was something when I was growing up that I never knew was coming or anything until someone pointed it out to me. Sometimes you go and you see the flag being hoisted up or put on someone's house. You're thinking, oh, dang it, it was Flag Day. I need to go put that up. And so I don't know if it was just being a young person and not remembering Flag Day, but nowadays I try and do my best to remember every holiday, every day of significance. For those of you who don't know why we celebrate Flag Day, essentially it's a commemoration of when the Stars and Stripes was officially accepted as the national banner, the national flag for the United States. It was accepted in 1777 as the national flag, which means the revolution was still going on at the time. But this was our symbol of independence. This was the symbol of we are Americans, we are not British. Up until that point, a lot of times the attitude was, well, we are kind of both British. It's just that we don't like what they're doing over there, and they don't like what they're expecting of us. They're trying to cram all their crap on us who don't who don't want to be involved with their taxes and everything. Carrying around that flag on the battlefield, of course, sort of showed the British that that's what our attitude was. A lot of areas, a lot of different regions, like the state, each state had its own flag, but this was the flag of the United States. This wasn't Georgia's flag. This wasn't Massachusetts' flag. This was not Virginia's flag. This represented all 13 colonies. And so that is why we commemorate June 14th, Flag Day. That's why we put up the banner there. This is when we stood up and said, this is the symbol of this country. And I wish I had a great Flag Day story to tell you, but my family never really talked much about Flag Day. They did remember to put up the flag on Flag Day. I think they remembered it every year. It's hard to say. And I'm just not sure what the attitude is in general about Flag Day. But most of the time, in most places, I do see people putting up American flags all over the place in honoring this. But I do have to wonder if they all realize or understand why we have that flag put up on that day. Because to them it's just Flag Day, and it's like, well, what's Flag Day? What are we celebrating? Why is it up here? Or whatever. Memorial Day and Veterans Day, it's kind of obvious by the name of the holiday why they're celebrating it. But Flag Day, they might be able to make an educated guess, but they're really not taught a lot about Flag Day in school. At least when I was in school, they really never talked about Flag Day. And that might be partly because Flag Day happens in the summertime and no one's at school on Flag Day, unless you get in trouble and you have to go to summer school. But luckily, that never happened to me. I almost didn't graduate, and that might have happened to me, but I did succeed. And so, persevered, and I got out of there. Remember, do not forget about Memorial Day, and always remember it. And, of course, with Flag Day, understand why people have those flags up, and always understand and respect people's attitudes and why they do what they do. That's what I have to say on those two topics. All right, now that we've talked about the Memorial Day, Flag Day, and the things that they represent and why they are so important, I want to take us towards a slightly different track, or rather largely different track, and that is, how many of you out there have ever played the license plate game? When you go on those long trips and you're just bored to tears and you don't know what to do, and the trend to see how many movies that you can name that have Mel Gibson in it, or that might have Denzel Washington in it, or Morgan Freeman, you'll probably name off maybe 10, 12, or whatever. And then the time sort of runs out, or you run out of names, and he says, how long was that? Oh, about 20 minutes, you know. And when you're on those long trips, 20 minutes is not going to cut it. And you're not going to be singing 10 billion bottles of beer on the wall. So what else do? You do the license plate game. And when I was a lot younger, my family used to drive from Concord, California to the Salt Lake area of Utah every year, at least once a year, sometimes twice, depending on if we wanted to spend Christmas there or not. Because my family, of course, originated in Utah before moving to California. I was personally born in California, so I still kind of see myself as a Californian, even though I'm living in Utah myself right now. While we are riding on these long trips, we're counting these plates, we're checking them all, and there were instances where you find yourself starting to act in odd ways just in order to catch those license plates. I mean, every time you're at a rest stop, you know, like sneaking up and looking at different cars, and people are like standing outside there, what the heck are those kids doing or whatever, and they might hear that, oh, they're playing the license plate game, and they're all, oh, okay, you know, those kids are playing the license plate game. They're probably not quite as comprehensible or understanding with your weird actions if you're playing the license plate game when you're an adult and you're acting funny. When I got older, I still play that license plate game. Every year I print out a list of states and check them off as I get them, because I noticed that if I just sit there and write them down, then we have to sit and figure out, okay, now which states don't we have? And then you have to kind of, I mean, luckily I know the names of all the states, but that doesn't mean you're going to figure out what were those last three that we haven't thought of yet. And it'll take forever sometimes, or you might notice that you wrote down Montana twice or something like that. So we're going out there, and sometimes, this is me as an adult, by the way, sometimes, you know, you find yourself, it's like, oh, what's that license plate when you're on the highway and you're kind of like driving up closer, you're speeding up so that you can get close enough to that plate to see it, and, you know, you might almost be tailgating them or whatever, and you better have someone in your passenger seat, because if you're on the highway and you're doing this and poking your head over to the side, you have a good chance of getting yourself into an accident. A couple times, me and some companions would, you know, we'd like, oh, what's that one? It kind of got away, and we'd speed up, change a couple lanes till we got really near near that plate in order to see it. And it makes for a really interesting experience. You just got to make sure you're not stupid, kind of like those people who whip out Pokemon Go, and even though it says it looks like you're driving, you always click I am a passenger even though you're not. And so I've already talked about Pokemon Go though, so anyways, so with the license plate game, you're just get caught up in it and you don't always realize what other people might be thinking of you. The people at the rest stops that you come across when you're doing those long trips from one end to the other. And, you know, my family did this traveling every single year since I was like a kid. And so I've always been playing this game ever since I can remember. There was a time when we were at a rest stop and there were a couple plates. Now, at rest stops on highways, I mean, those are golden opportunities where you see a lot of people coming from all over the place to stop and get gas or whatever. And these people, many of them have been driving for who knows how many miles. Some of them, you know, many of them are from way out of state. And oddly enough, I probably have seen almost every Canadian province as well while I'm at it. But while I've been doing this, there are like two states that just I could never seem to find. Delaware and Rhode Island. I mean, even Hawaii was easier for me to get than Delaware and Rhode Island. I have yet to even see them. So we're just trying to go all over the place. Every year we'd start over and we'd go looking, and it's like, dang it, those two states, we just can't get them. You might say, well, if you do a lifetime long search, then maybe just finding them, you can say, yay, I've seen all 50 states at some point in my life. Of course, you could just go fly to Delaware and Rhode Island to do that. So I don't really consider that a great accomplishment. So, you know, you're trying to get this all done in a year. And in order to do that, you just have to sometimes just keep your eyes open every time you're on the road. Or it's like, oh, my neighbor's got a Vermont plate. There we go. That's done and over with. I don't know how many of you out there play that game or not, but it's one of those things that I'm instinctively playing all the time. And I think I'll probably continue doing that even after I have found Rhode Island and Delaware at some point in my life. Anyways, steering from the license plate game, there's another direction that I want to go really quickly. And this came up to me as I was watching a documentary about volcanic eruptions. Volcanic eruptions, of course, they happen all over the place, but me growing up in California, and think, oh, well, that never really happens near me, and so these volcanic eruptions don't affect me at all. But you find out a little later that even though you don't see the eruptions, they still affect you in one way or another. Back in 1980, when Mount St. Helens erupted, it was all over the news and everything, but I didn't live in Washington, I was in California. And I thought, oh, that's terrible for those people, but that didn't affect me at all, and life went on. And I hadn't thought of the large-scale environmental thing before until I saw there was an instance where there was a lunar eclipse that was happening. And you'd go outside and you'd look at it, and usually when you look at a lunar eclipse, the moon turns a kind of bluish red color before it goes dark, and that's because of atmospheric coloring, the sunlight flaring off of gases in the atmosphere. This instance with Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, all of a sudden the lunar eclipse happened, but the moon just went dark. It didn't turn blood red first. And I thought, wow, what happened here? It's like, ooh, is some biblical prophecy coming to pass about the moon phasing out or whatever? Just nonsense like that. Then you find out, well, actually, a volcano erupted, Mount Pinatubo erupted in the Philippines, and that is affecting the atmosphere there, and therefore you aren't going to see that reddish hue color. And you're thinking, okay, so a volcanic eruption on the other side of the Pacific actually affected this. Now, running fast forward to 2010, that was the year that I went to London for a study abroad. A study abroad program with the English department at UVU. Of course, I was just thinking, okay, I'm just going to jump at this opportunity to go to London and worry about paying off debt later. I mean, it did hurt paying off that debt, but I think in the end, I think it was worth it. So we set up to go to London, and a month before we were supposed to fly out, or a little less than a month before, a volcano erupts in Iceland. This volcano erupting in Iceland, I mean, if you look at the news in Iceland, you see stuff billowing out of this volcano, but it's a clear sky. And you're thinking, huh, they've got like clear skies in Iceland, even though that volcano's erupting. And it's like, well, it's not a full blown out eruption, of course, but it was really billowing, billowing ash and smoke and everything. But instead of it covering Iceland, it was blowing south over the British Isles and Northern Europe. And actually, some parts of the British Isles and Northern Europe, when they showed a map of it, it had some weird squiggly thing that they said was the result of wind, you know, the winds in the islands and how it was moving the smoke around. Because of this, a lot of flights were being grounded on their way to the British Isles. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, is this going to affect our trip? And I was assured, okay, this isn't going to affect it. By the time the things will be cleared up mostly by the time that we end up going there. And so when I got to London, I was almost expecting to see the sky covered with dark clouds because of volcanic activity. But of course, it wasn't. Having that thought in my head, I was thinking, okay, so we have all these superstitions and all these ideas about what happens when a volcano goes off. Some people believe that a volcano in Iceland is one of the reasons why back in the 1800s, the horrible year called the Year Without a Summer happened. And apparently at that time, a lot of crops ended up dying because of this haze that came over everything, and the temperature dropped worldwide like 2 degrees. The farmers had recently just sheared their sheep, but then when the temperature dropped, all of a sudden snow would come down, all these sheep were killed off. Let's just say economically today, that would be disaster if we were relying on a lot of things that require growth. And farmers, if the farmers in this country just suddenly had all their crops gone, what would happen to us today? And that was part of the thing that it's like, gee, I'm sure glad that the eruption in Iceland was not that bad. The Icelandic people, as all Norse people do, they have their myths about what a volcano is and what it does. There are no volcanoes in mainland Scandinavia. They're only in Iceland and around those areas. And of course, there's none in Greenland, and there's none in what they call Vinland in North America. And so when the Vikings, they did not get to Iceland until about close to 1000 AD. And so odds are they didn't know about volcanoes all that much. I mean, who knows? They may have seen things like when the Vikings were moving around Italy, they could have seen Sicily's volcano go off or Italy's volcanoes go off, but nothing around where they live themselves. And so gods, the forge, there's a forge god, of course, that involves fire, and that the eruption of the volcano is the forge god doing his work, or he's angry and trying to clear out, eliminate the negative things that are in culture. And a lot of things like that come up in ideas. So as you can see, when people move to different places, or when you see different places that have really no connection to volcanoes, they still are affected by them, and culture gets affected as well. People calling on the fire gods, "Oh, save us, don't harm us," or the year without a summer, people wondering what the heck people do, or what horrible thing are the people guilty of that caused this to happen. Whenever I think about these volcanoes, I wonder what everyone's thinking about, and how that actually can change the culture in an area where people had not experienced it yet. So I believe I'm going to end this podcast here, and I thank you all for listening to this seventh episode of Balladition-ish. I just love looking at a lot of these kinds of stories. I was thinking of reading off a Norse story about volcanoes, but I just don't have the time at this point. As always, if you have any ideas or things that you want me to talk about in one of these podcasts, you can let me know at folklorenow33@gmail.com. Anything folkloric that you can think of that I may not have talked about, or if you have a story that you have that you'd like to tell yourself and record it, go ahead and send it to me, or a song or whatever. I'll listen to it, and who knows, you may hear it on this particular podcast. So anyways, I thank you all for listening, and hope you all have a wonderful day, and I'll see you all next time on the next episode of Balladish Anish, Folklore Now.